It's the Friday edition of the Large Morning Show in the afternoon here on the Big 550 KTRS. I am Paul Harris. Ian Geis and Dan Strauss are here in the studio with me, and on the phone now is Clint Hill. Clint Hill spent 17 years, from 1958 to 1975, protecting presidents of this United States, and writes about the experience in a new book called Five Presidents. It's about his years with Presidents Eisenhower, Kennedy, Johnson, Nixon, and Ford. He was at the White House through the Cold War and the Cuban Missile Crisis and the assassinations and the Vietnam War and the Vietnam War protests and Watergate and other world-changing events. He retired in 1975 as assistant director responsible for all protective forces, but is still involved with the people of the Secret Service. And it's an honor to have him on the show here to talk about the book and to promote an appearance he's going to be doing here in St. Louis next Thursday, May 19th, at the Missouri History Museum. Clint Hill, welcome to the Big 550 KTRS.
Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Before we get into other things, I've got to ask you about a silly thing first. A few weeks ago, I saw this movie, Elvis and Nixon, which is about the true life story of when Elvis Presley went to the White House in 1970, showed up unannounced at the northwest gate of the White House when President Nixon was in the building and said, I want to meet the president, and he brought a letter with him. And were you there during that time?
I was in my office a block and a half from the White House. My responsibility was then, I was a deputy assistant director of protective forces, and the White House detail and the uniform division came under our office. And yes, I was fully aware of what was going on. My secretary came running in to my office and said, you're not going to believe this, but Elvis Presley just showed up at the Northwest Gate. And I said, was it really him? And she said, yep, he wants to see the president. Well, what happened was he came there unannounced, not invited. He had a letter that he had written while he was flying into Washington, and he wanted to see the president because he wanted the president to make him a federal agent involved in drug enforcement, because he thought that since he had such a wonderful relationship with young America, he could make a difference in the drug war.
And he wanted to do it undercover because he was an expert in disguise, having made movies.
That's why he wore that velvet suit, I guess.
and a giant gold belt buckle the size of Rhode Island.
That's right, yeah. And then he brought a gun as a present for the president. Fortunately, it was in a picture frame, but we had to examine it anyway.
So I'm curious, what happened? You get your secretary tells you about that, so you've gotten that phone call, and your office knows about it, and he's at the Northwest Gate. What's the process from there? What do you do?
What happened was he gave the letter to the uniformed officer, and he was turned away because he didn't have an appointment.
Mm-hmm.
So he went back to his hotel. The letter then was taken in and given to one of Nixon's staff. I think it was a man named Bud Krogh.
Mm-hmm.
And Bud looked at the letter and realized what a great publicity event this was. And so he got the hold of his boss, Bob Haldeman, and they went in and explained it to the president, and he said, bring him in. So they contacted him. He came back to the White House. He had a meeting with the president. There were photos taken of him in the office with the president. And they did arrange to get him an honorary federal drug enforcement badge, which had no legitimate authority whatsoever.
Yeah.
But at least it made him happy, and he went away a happy man.
Wow. Have you seen the movie?
No, unfortunately, but I'm looking forward to seeing it.
You lived it, so I'm sure you'll sit there and laugh and remember all these bizarre things that happened. And by the way, I thought that was the oddest story I'd ever heard about the Nixon White House, and I'd heard it for decades. And then I read in your book, there was one that made me raise my eyebrows even more, Clint, and that was the story about Richard Nixon deciding about 4 o'clock in the morning, when there were going to be hundreds of thousands of people protesting the war on the Mall in Washington, he decided to go to the Lincoln Memorial at 4 in the morning, right?
Yes, he did. And it really angered me, because we had gone to the trouble of working with the military and the district police and the park police, acquiring hundreds of buses, lining them up bumper to bumper around the entire perimeter of the White House complex to prevent anybody from even thinking about getting in. And then he, at 4:30 in the morning, decides he wants to go out of that secure complex. And so the agents that were working the midnight shift took him down to the Lincoln Memorial. And he walked around. He had his valet with him, Manolo, and his, a doctor, Dr. Walter Dakash. And he went down there, and he was explaining to Manolo what the memorial represented. And then he sat down on the steps amongst the students that were there. They were demonstrating. He found out that a big number were there from Syracuse University. So he decided to try and talk to them about their football team.
Now, well, I just got to stop you for a second, because this is while Richard Nixon was the sitting president of the United States, and there are 100,000 students getting ready for a gigantic rally against his policies in Vietnam.
That's correct. More than 100,000.
Yeah.
The city was just filled with young people willing to do anything to get their point across.
Yep.
And so do you think those Syracuse University kids really thought they wanted to talk about the football team? I don't think so.
No.
The agents that were with him said he just didn't make any sense at all.
Now, you must have been freaking out when you thought, when you heard, again, just like the Elvis thing, you got to go, what?
Well, he didn't even stop there. They finally got him in the car. They thought they were going back to the White House, but then he insisted on going up to the U.S. Capitol. He wanted to show his valet his Senate seat. So they get to the Senate side, and it's locked. They can't get in. So they go over to the House side, because he was also a congressman at one time. And there was a janitor or somebody there, had a key, let him in. He goes into the House chamber, finds a seat. Then he directs his valet to go up and sit in the Speaker's chair and address the empty legislative body.
What in the world? Was he on some drugs or something?
Wow.
Well, I won't comment about that part.
Oh.
But,
he was smoking.
It was rather unusual.
Yeah. You know, we could talk about Nixon all day long, but I want to touch on a couple of the other people you talk about. After all, it was five presidents. So let's talk about LBJ for just a second. There's been a lot of renewed attention on Lyndon Johnson, and particularly civil rights, in the last couple of years. We had the movie Selma a couple of years ago. Bryan Cranston won a Tony for playing Johnson on Broadway in a play called All the Way, which is going to be turned into an HBO presentation next week. You write in the book about a group of students who, during that time, went to the White House. I think it was in 1964, where they were on a regular tour and just sat down and staged a sit-in in the White House lobby. Do I have my timing right on this?
Yeah, that's correct. They actually sat in a passageway where normally tourists come through, on the lower level, in the kind of a, it's near the theater, and they just sat down, and they wouldn't move. And they had to reroute the tourists that were behind them. And so Rufus Youngblood, who was one of our agents, he was the agent in charge of Johnson at that time, and he went up and told LBJ what was going on. And they decided just to leave him, let him sit there. They didn't want to cause a major problem. But they stayed and stayed. They wouldn't go. They stayed through lunch. They stayed. And then there was going to be a function in the White House that night. It was going to be a reception. So we had to get him out of there. So finally, he said, okay, make it as quiet as possible. Do it as no publicity as possible. Get them out. So we did. They brought in cars on that end of the White House, and we brought them out, and they took them down to be arraigned and talked to a judge. So we did satisfactorily get a conclusion that met everybody's desires, but that was typical.
But that must have changed. That must have changed White House security and the way tours were treated going forward.
Well, sure. Gave us a new look at things. We didn't think that people would be willing to do that, but they are, or they were, and So we had to make some adjustments.
Okay, now speaking of things that must have changed policy, 1968 was one of the most torturous times in American history in that era. It was the year that we had both Martin Luther King and Robert F. Kennedy assassinated a couple of months apart in April and June of 1968. And that summer we had the Democratic Convention in Chicago that ended in riots. And I'm curious about what the Secret Service must have had to ramp up that year. And, of course, you famously were there when President John Kennedy was assassinated, which you wrote about in your book 5 Days in November, and also Mrs. Kennedy and Me, two great books, by the way. I'm curious about what you took from that experience into 1968 when we had those two other huge political assassinations in terms of protecting the then-sitting president, LBJ.
Well, after the assassination, we, the agents, we all vowed this was never going to happen again in our watch. And so we were much more focused from that point on than we had been before, even though we were very focused before. But we wanted to make sure there was nothing that left undone to make sure we had adequate protection at all times. And it was difficult. The night that Martin Luther King was assassinated, it was that was only 5 days after Johnson had announced he wasn't going to run for president again. Which happened March 31st, and King was killed on April 4th. And he went to a service for him the next day, and in the middle of the night before the service, he called me at my home. I had a White House phone direct line right beside my bed. And he called me about 2:30 in the morning, and he told me that wanted to make sure I was fully aware that he was going there that morning to that service. And then he wanted to make sure that we kept the car that he was in up as close to the door as we could get it. And then he said, Clint, he said, I want you as close to me as white on rice when we go into that service and during the service and come out. And then I was. I was inches away at all time. And he was concerned about his own safety at that point. And it was, normal, I thought, that he should be concerned, because we had no idea, really, if this, what happened to King, would be something that they would try against Johnson or not. We always had to be on our top game, because we never were fully aware of what was going to happen next.
Absolutely. Well, Clint, I got to tell you, the last part of the book is about the night in 1975 after you had retired, where you sat down with Mike Wallace for 60 minutes, and you opened up about being there when JFK was assassinated, and you blamed yourself. And I remember watching that night and seeing how you were so obviously torn apart by grief and guilt, and I know it led to a spiral into depression and all sorts of other problems. How are you now on that subject?
Well, thankfully, after I met this lady, Lisa McCubbin, who was a writer, she was working on a book with a friend of mine, and they asked me to help them because I was in Dallas and the other agent was not. And after that, I had confidence and trust in Lisa, and I began to talk to her more and more, long distance by telephone, but it was beneficial. And the more I talked, the better I felt. And then I was convinced that maybe I should write a book. And that's how Mrs. Kennedy and Me was created. Mm-hmm. And that was very cathartic for me. That's the best thing I did for myself, was agree to talk to Lisa and get all that emotional baggage out, because I was really suffering from what now is called PTSD. There wasn't anything, any name like that at that time, but that's what it was. And unless you get that emotional baggage out by talking to someone about it, really expressing yourself, then you're really going to have a problem for a long time.
Well, you've retained your relationship with Lisa McCubbin. She's your co-author on this book, which is called Five Presidents, about your extraordinary career with Presidents Eisenhower, Kennedy, Johnson, Nixon, and Ford. And I could talk to you about this all day long, but I'm going to tell people to go see you instead next Thursday night at 7 o'clock at the Missouri History Museum. You can go to meetmestlouis.org to find out more information. You can get a copy of the book there and have Clint sign it for you, and he'll do a Q&A and all the rest. It's really an honor to talk to you, and I appreciate your time today.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
The book is Five Presidents. More information about his appearance at meetmestlouis.org.